USA Today. I'm sitting in for Diane this week. She's out with a cold. On my mind this week, President Trump bans transgender people from serving in the military, makes disparaging remarks about his Attorney General Jeff Sessions, and revels in three campaign-style speeches outside the Beltway. New York Times reporter Peter Baker, who recently interviewed the president, shared some insights.
He is so different than any other president before us in every possible way. For a reporter, that's a fascinating story to cover.
Then Jason Kander, the 36-year-old vet who nearly unseated Republican Senator Roy Blunt of Missouri last November, talked about why he thinks the Democratic Party is a better deal.
Well, look, I just think it's a fact. I mean, what our party is offering is a better deal, particularly if you compare it to what President Trump is offering the American people right now.
First, Peter Baker, chief White House correspondent for The New York Times. Hey, Peter, you and I have covered previous administrations, but I think there has never been a president quite like Donald Trump. Do you agree, for the reporters who are at the White House every day, as you are right now, is it different?
Oh, yeah. No, radically different. I used to actually think, and I don't know if you agree, I used to think that presidents were more alike than not, regardless of party, even personality, that there were rhythms to the place and the job, and there are dynamics that were more or less similar, and the constraints and the opportunities and the options were pretty close to the same, regardless of who happened to be in. This is a guy who proves the opposite, right? He's the exception that proves the rule. He is so different than any other president before us in every possible way, in personality, in leadership approach, in style, in just how he views life. And, for a reporter, that's a fascinating story to cover.
You know, I used to think this is the sixth president I've had some part in covering. And I used to think they were pretty different, Ronald Reagan and Bill Clinton and Barack Obama. And now I think those previous five presidents seem much more alike. And it is as though Donald Trump is just a different species entirely.
Yeah, as presidents go, I think that's exactly right. And you've covered more than I have, but I've covered four. And I think that, the similarities between the others seem much stronger to me now than they once did. And, this is one of the things that has made Trump successful, right? That the people who voted for him wanted somebody who wasn't just like all the others. They wanted somebody who would break China. They wanted somebody who wouldn't just go along to get along. Well, that's what they're getting. Now, there are trade-offs, obviously. There's advantages and disadvantages to that. And I think you see these days with some of the problems on legislation and policy and personnel that, there are going to be costs. But they, so far don't seem to trouble President Trump very much.
I guess, like with all of us, his strength is his weakness when it comes to being a disruptive force.
Yeah, that's right.
Part of it also is just the velocity of news. Just thinking about this week, we've had the crucial Senate debate on health care, the president's public attacks on Jeff Sessions as attorney general, the decision to reimpose a ban on transgender troops in the military, which was a decision that came in an early morning tweet, which is a tool that we see President Trump using quite a bit. Has that changed the way you staff the White House to look out for this early morning Twitter activity?
Yeah, no, it definitely has. When I started at the White House in 1996, we had two of us who covered the White House, which seems quaint today. Today we have six. And even that, I feel like we're, some days overwhelmed by the intensity and the volume of news. So, we have a couple of people who are on duty on any given week, and that duty person is supposed to be, up before dawn, keeping an eye on Twitter just to make sure news hasn't happened. We've actually just hired a whole other person on top of the six, who's just an early morning web reporter who can write up quick things if we don't get to them. So we're so attuned to the new rhythms of this White House and how things work that we have had to adjust our own processes.
This has caused some debate in the USA Today newsroom. I wonder if it has at the New York Times as well, about kind of how to handle and approach President Trump's tweets, because sometimes they seem like a way to distract attention from some other more important story that's going on Russia or healthcare, but they are so hard to ignore. Is this a dilemma for you all sometimes?
We talk about that too, but I don't think you could ignore that. If President Reagan or President Clinton had gotten up at the podium and said the things that President Trump says on tweets, we absolutely would have covered it. So the fact that the modality is different, I don't think changes that. I think that, you know, we can walk and chew gum at the same time. We can still focus on other big, important stories and not be distracted just by the shiny object. But I think that the shiny object actually is important, too. It tells you about how this president operates. It tells you about our leadership. It tells you about, you know, very important things. If we ignore the tweets about the attorney general, what would we do? You know, I mean, this his anger at Jeff Sessions over being over recusing himself on the Russia investigation is incredibly telling. He wanted somebody at the Justice Department who would protect him. And so the fact that it comes out by Twitter sometimes as opposed to other means, I don't think matters too much. And I think that, you know, obviously we don't cover every single tweet, but we evaluate them using the same news judgment we would if he had gotten up at the podium or put out a written statement.
Do you think that President Trump sometimes deliberately posts a provocative tweet to change the subject from Russia or some other topic?
Yeah, but possibly I do. But the truth is, a lot of things he posts then are hardly better stories. You know what I mean? He's not posting, you know, a tweet saying, you know, gosh, the economy is great in order to distract us. He's posting things that create other controversies and that have their own negative consequences to them. So, you know, somebody used the analogy of, you know, don't pay attention to that burning house. I'm going to put myself on fire. Okay, but I don't know that that's any better. To put a tweet up, for instance, about, you know, accusing President Obama of having illegally wiretapped you when there's absolutely zero evidence of it at all, hardly, you know, in my view, made things better for him on other stories, you know?
One of the things I admire about President Trump is that he is pretty transparent in terms
yes.
of what he's thinking. And you see
yeah.
that on, there's no filter on Twitter. I also admire the fact that he continues to do interviews.
Yes.
And he did an interview, an amazing interview with you and some other New York Times reporters last week that created a lot of news. Tell us how that came about. How did the interview get set up?
Yeah, well, first of all, I agree with you entirely. I actually think that the one great advantage for reporters in this White House is we don't have to guess what the president is thinking. I mean, we have a really, you know, unusual, if not unprecedented, window into a president's mindset and thinking and mood more than we ever have ever before, right? We didn't know necessarily what George Bush was thinking or Barack Obama was thinking. We could guess, we could interpret it, we did criminology. Ah, he said this word instead of that word, that probably means this, or aides would tell us that. We have a real-time window into this president's thinking. And from a reporter's point of view, that's amazing. That's an extraordinary thing. And you're right, he does continue to give interviews. And he gave one to the New York Times, of all places, the failing New York Times, just last week. And so I'm obviously glad about that. We had gone in to see him. We asked if we'd be on the record. And he said, sure. And we knew that he would do that, by the way. That is his habit. If you ask him to be on the record, he is more likely than not going to say yes, because I think he enjoys that. I think he enjoys the give and take. He wants to have his voice out there. Other presidents would worry and think about it, and they would calculate and plot and say, well, we can't be on the record. We can't do this interview because it'll distract from this message or that message. This guy doesn't worry about that. He just says, I got something to say, and I want you to hear it.
So the first interview with the president I ever did in the Oval Office was President Reagan. And it was also the worst interview I ever did with a president. It was like, I went in, and I couldn't believe I was in the Oval Office, and I was talking to the president of the United States, and I asked very lame questions. I broke zero news. And since then, I got to say, I've never gone into an interview with a president or a big figure like that without having a strategy that I've tried to think
yes.
through beforehand. So before this interview that you had with President Trump, did you all sit down and try to strategize about how to handle it?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Absolutely. And I totally agree with you. You cannot go into a presidential interview without a strategy. But what's different here is when you interview President Reagan or Clinton or Bush, the challenge was, how do you get them off the talking points, right? How do you get them to say something that they haven't said a million times before? Because that's what they're programmed to do. They're programmed to give the same stock answer to every question. They've heard every question before. And the best questioners, the best interviewers, the best reporters at press conferences are those who come up with questions that surprise them and throw them off their game a little bit, right? The John Dickerson question to George W. Bush, sir, what's your biggest mistake since you've taken office? It completely befuddled President Bush 43, and he couldn't give an answer, and it was very telling. So the difference here is that you don't have to actually worry about him sticking to the script. President Trump doesn't do that. He is, if you ask him a question, he's going to answer it. And he's going to tell you, for the most part, I think, what he thinks. So another president, if we had asked about the Russia investigation, as we did, would have almost certainly said, well, that's under investigation. I can't comment on an ongoing investigation. And we would have tried again and a couple of times, and he would have shut us down by saying the same thing. And then we would have had to move on, and he could talk about other things he might want to talk about. That wasn't the case here. He didn't shut us down. He very happily and eagerly went along with every question we asked about that, and seemed, you know, completely unbothered to talk about it. And so that's the calculation and the strategizing is different because of that.
In talking to him in this interview, did you get the sense, it's easy to get the sense from the outside that President Trump is obsessed with the Russia investigation. Is that the sense you got in talking to him directly about it?
I would say he's definitely absorbed by it, no question, that this is on his mind a lot. I mean, in fairness, we were the ones who brought it up. He didn't. But it definitely consumes a lot of his bandwidth. And it gnaws at him. It bothers him, irritates him. You know, looking at it from his point of view, you know, he thinks he did nothing wrong. And so this is just a witch hunt. This is just, you know, people trying to delegitimize his victory last year. And that's why I asked him, actually. You know, I said, look, what about this line in the email that was sent to Don Jr.? It said that the meeting was set up as part of the Russia government's support for your candidacy. He said, well, I didn't know about that meeting at the time. I said, yeah, but that's not the point. You know about this now. What does that mean to you? Does that tell you anything? And he just can't see that through anything other than the lens of somebody's attacking my victory. It's all coming after me, rather than saying, well, actually, you know, it's interesting that the Russian government, you know, had some intent to support a candidate in our election. So I think it sort of absorbs him, and he spends a lot of time thinking about it.
Do you think that the attacks on Jeff Sessions, the quite extraordinary public attacks on his own attorney general, are designed to ultimately position him to fire the special counsel, Robert Mueller?
I think that's certainly a possibility that, you know, he is, if he finds a way to remove Jeff Sessions, he perhaps could put in somebody else as Attorney General who would then be directed to fire Robert Mueller. He said in our interview that Robert Mueller had conflicts of interest. It's not an accidental phrase. The regulations say that you can fire a special counsel only under certain circumstances, one of them being conflicts of interest. So you could see him sort of potentially setting the stage for that. He also could be just potentially, you know, sending a warning shot, maybe not necessarily intending to, but wanting people to think he's intending to, in order to, you know, get in the head of the other team, as it were, right? So that Robert Mueller at least knows that this is a possibility, and it may shape or influence his conduct of the investigation. Now, Mueller's a pretty independent guy. He was FBI director for 12 years under two different presidents of different parties, and I don't think he's easily intimidated or swayed. But it is a good question.
I can't imagine the firestorm we would see if the president fired the special counsel.
I agree. I mean, like, every time I've said, well, this is just, you know, so unprecedented. Of course, it will be, you know, have huge consequences. You know, it hasn't always turned out exactly as I thought, because, you know, lots of things that would have hurt or even killed an ordinary politician, you know, have just rolled off of President Trump's back. But I do think that firing Robert Mueller would be potentially a very you know, explosive, not potentially, it would be explosive, no question about it. And it might be the thing that really turns Republicans, at least a lot of Republicans, against President Trump. You've heard that from some members of Congress laying down the line saying, you know, don't fire Mueller. You can't do that. He's an honorable guy. He's somebody that we respect. And if you fire him, it will send all the wrong signals about your commitment to, you know, a fair and independent investigation.
I agree with you, although I have to admit I've said that on several occasions over the past
yeah.
year and been proven wrong. Well, Ted, what do you think? How do you think Trump is feeling? Do you think he likes being president?
That's an excellent question. I think he likes some aspects of being president for sure. I think he had a good time in France watching the Bastille Day parade. And I think he enjoyed being on the Gerald R. Ford commissioning a new aircraft carrier last weekend in Norfolk. I think he definitely enjoys the magisterial elements of being president. I think he likes being charged. I think he likes being a winner. I don't know that he likes the policy nitty gritty. I don't know that he likes, you know, the hassles of legislating. I think he's surprised by how complicated and aggravating it can be. Something, by the way, every president eventually feels. But I, you know, it's a good question how much he likes it. He has said that he likes it. When we saw him in the interview, he was in a good mood. He seemed upbeat. He said comfortable, confident, you know, relaxed. So, but, you know, this is, he never done this before. He'd never been in politics before. All of this is new.
I had one of the last interviews with George W. Bush in the Oval Office, and one of the things he said to me was that Barack Obama was going to be surprised at how hard the job was. And I interviewed Barack Obama a couple years later, and I think that was probably a pretty fair assessment.
I think you're right. Yeah, I think he was.
Now, I know that you were on the road with President Trump some this week. He went outside the Beltway, did some campaign-style rallies. That is a situation in which he seems to be in his element.
He is. He loves the rally, no question about it. We went to Youngstown, Ohio.
With the incredible men and women of Youngstown.
We filled the stadium there. It takes around 7,000 people. You know, there's nothing but shouts of love and support and affirmation. It's very affirming, right? He doesn't get a lot of love inside the Beltway. But his supporters outside the Beltway are cheering him on. They're egging him on. They like the feisty way he approaches this. They like the idea that he's fighting for them. The fact that he might not necessarily be succeeding isn't even necessarily the most important thing. They just see him not compromising and not giving in their view, to, you know, Washington politics as it normally is practiced. And so, yeah, he just drank it in. He loved every minute of it, I think. It was he was in a good mood that later that evening when we saw him on the plane coming back.
You wrote an interesting piece the other day that said that President Trump has actually changed our collective understanding of what it means to be president. What did you mean by that?
Yeah, no, I think that's true. Things, you know, he has crossed so many lines. He has, you know, discarded with so many taboos, so many, you know, red lines that, you know, it takes a lot these days to be surprised. So he gets up in front of the Boy Scouts in West Virginia, and I was there, and kind of a political speech. And, you know, he attacks, you know, and jabs anyway. Attacks may be strong, but he jabs Barack Obama. He jabs Hillary Clinton. He talks about his Manhattan cocktail parties where the hot people were, and it was a pretty unusual speech. And the truth is, like, we're so used to him doing things other presidents haven't done at this point that it didn't even surprise me. Look at what we've seen. We've got a president who doesn't release his tax forms, who kept his business, who, you know, fired the FBI director, who has, you know, whiplashed his own attorney general in public. I mean, every time we turn around, he does things that you know, none of the presidents you and I covered before would have ever thought about doing. And it changes our bar for outrage. It changes our bar for surprise. So that, you know, well, that's just Trump. People are used to it.
Is it a permanent change? Do we, after post-Trump, do we go back to the old order?
That's a good question, right? Does the genie go back in the bottle? Does the Pandora's box get closed again? I tend to think that whoever comes next will, Republican or Democrat, will want to be the opposite, just to sort of say, okay, you know, I'm a different type of person. I'm not that kind of person. And a lot of the norms and you know, boundaries that we have had in the past will probably be restored. But we don't know that for sure. You know, David Axelrod, President Obama's strategist, said that, you know, we tend to look in the next president for a remedy, not a replica, right? Well, the remedy then would be somebody who does actually want to observe the protocols and the sort of the quorum that we're used to in a presidency, not be another Trump. That would be a normal reaction. But we'll see. I don't know.
Two final things I'd like to ask you about. First, there seems to be tremendous turmoil in the White House. And we've had Sean Spicer, the press secretary, leave. Anthony Scaramucci coming on as communications director, and an extraordinary war being waged on Twitter between the new communications director and the current chief of staff, Reince Priebus. What's happening there?
Well, you know, it's a very good question. You know, Anthony Scaramucci said that he and Reince and Priebus are like brothers.
When I said we were brothers from the podium, that's because we're rough on each other. Some brothers are like Cain and Abel.
But that some brothers might be like Cain and Abel.
Other brothers can fight with each other and then get along. I don't know if this is repairable or not. That will be up to the president.
And that's obviously a pretty stark analogy if we think about it, because, of course, one of those guys ends up dead. So it's a very, again, from a reporter's point of view, it's great because all these things play out in public. Every White House has its rivalries. Every White House has its, you know, internal schisms and tensions. But I've never seen one play out in public the way this one does. And it's rather stunning. Again, going back to your previous question, you know, at what point do we lose our sense of shock or surprise? But this still managed to surprise me.
By any conventional standard, it's hard to imagine that both of these individuals continue to serve on the White House staff.
Again, the word you see is conventional. That's right. Under any conventional White House, they wouldn't. You and I know, right, that had Jim Baker, with Ronald Reagan's senior staff, been called out in public by a junior official in his, that is junior to him, in the White House, he would be out by the end of the day, right? But I don't think that's, you know, Anthony Scaramucci doesn't believe he works for Reince Priebus. He believes he works for the President of the United States. And there's a whole different pecking order, a whole different chain of command, a whole different organizational structure to this White House. And all the spokes lead back to one place, and that's the Oval Office.
Peter, last question. So did Donald Trump, the president, now Peter, one last question. Donald Trump, the president of the United States, routinely refers to your organization as the failing New York Times. And I wonder, does that bother you?
No, it really doesn't. Look, we just got our quarterly report this week. Our total revenues are up 9%. Our subscriptions are growing at 69%, more than they were at this time last year. So if we're failing, boy, I tell you, let's keep failing. It's great. And I think it's just name calling. And I don't think we as reporters should worry about name calling. I think we should worry about things like access. We should worry about things that make it harder for us to do our job. But the name calling stuff, we should just not rise to the bait. We're not the opposition. I know they like to say that we are. We're not. We're here to be an independent voice, an independent institution in American democracy. And so if politicians want to bash us, that's fine. I get it. No politician ever lost votes by bashing the press. But we should just get up and do our job as professionally and honestly and thoroughly as possible. And that's always the best answer.
Peter, we'll let you get back to work. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And now, a quick break.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
And we're back. Hey, Jason Kander, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Happy to be with you.
I caught up with Jason Kander, founder and president of Let America Vote and former Secretary of State in Missouri. You know, for listeners who may not know precisely who you are, let me just say a couple things in introduction. You're 36 years old. You served in the Army National Guard. You got a law degree. You volunteered for a tour of duty in Afghanistan. You were elected to the Missouri House of Representatives as a Democrat in 2008 and then served as the state's Secretary of State. But you know what really got people's attention outside of Missouri was how close you came last year to beating the Republican Senator Roy Blunt, who was up for re-election. Now you've launched a different sort of campaign. Tell us what you're doing today.
Sure. So I founded Let America Vote. I'm the president of Let America Vote. Let America Vote is the first political organization that's created to create political consequences for politicians who try and make it harder to vote. So for a while now, over a decade, the Republican Party has made it a core part of their political strategy to just try and make it harder to vote for folks who are a lot less likely to vote Republican. And you know, they pretend that this is a policy difference between the parties, but that's really not true. It's a political strategy by them that's no different than where they run their TV ads or whose doors they knock on in campaigns. They're just, you know, rather than reach out to certain voters, they're just deciding to make it harder for those folks to actually vote. I got a problem with that. And so we're working very hard and have had a lot of success so far in creating consequences. We've been around about 5 months, over 50,000 folks nationwide have signed up to volunteer. And it's really exciting to be a part of.
Is the Republican strategy working in some states, or this effort that you cite to try to hold down voter turnout among some groups, has it succeeded?
Well, I think a lot of people would argue it has. I mean, if you look at Wisconsin last year, Wisconsin has some of the most extreme anti-voting laws in the country. You had, by some estimates, as many as 300,000 eligible registered voters who didn't have the identification that is required in order to vote. And President Trump won Wisconsin by about 20,000 votes. So really, if you were to look at his reelection strategy, plank number one in their plan is to make it harder to vote for folks who are not likely to vote for Donald Trump. And if they can make the whole country look like Wisconsin, then that's what they're going to do. And the way that they're trying to do that is by actively working to undermine faith in American democracy, making up what I believe is the biggest lie a sitting president has ever told, saying that there were millions of illegal votes in the election when that's just a lie. And they're doing that so that people will allow them to pass laws that make it real hard to vote.
You said that you want your group to create political consequences for officials who move to suppress. But what kind of political consequences are you talking about?
Well, for instance, we believe that if you make it harder to vote, it should be a lot harder for you to get reelected. So, for instance, right now in Virginia, where they have elections coming up this November, we have about 50 people on the ground making hundreds of thousands of voter contacts, targeting, not just making sure that somebody who favors voting rights, the Democratic candidate, is in the governor's mansion. But also, we have about 10 state legislative districts that we're working on there, eight of which are districts that are currently held by Republicans that are anti-voting, that we are working to flip. So that would be a good example of, you know, because in the past, honestly, what would happen is, you know, it's not like there's an interest group in the country known as big voter, right? So if somebody, casts a vote that is anti-voting rights, there's not generally been a political consequence for that. And we believe it's time for that to change.
You know, you're chairing the Democratic National Committee's Voting Rights Commission, which I think was set up kind of in response to the Trump administration commission that's targeting voter fraud. First of all, do you think there is voter fraud in this country?
Well, look, you are statistically more likely to be struck by lightning as an American than you are to commit voter impersonation fraud, which is the only kind of voter fraud that a photo ID requirement can even pretend to prevent. So the purpose of the Trump commission, they picked Secretary of State Chris Kobach from Kansas to lead it, who is, you know, the chief vote suppressor in the country. This is a guy who spent just tons of taxpayer dollars from Kansans to try and prove the existence of voter fraud. And in 1.7 million cases, I think he has 9 convictions. So, you know, out of that many votes, he has that many convictions. So, look, they don't have a commission to look into lightning strikes. And that happens more often than this. So I think that answers the question pretty clearly.
So what do you think that commission is? What's the agenda of that commission, do you think?
Well, the GOP voter suppression playbook. As you mentioned, I was elected Secretary of State in Missouri in 2012. So for 4 years, I was the chief election official in Missouri. And I've seen this voter suppression playbook up close and personal. There's 3 steps to it. The first step is you undermine faith in democracy. And the second step is you create obstacles to voting. The third step is you create obstacles to those obstacles. Well, this commission is firmly in the step one spot. They want to create the impression that there are widespread problems. This commission will do one of 2 things. They will either come to a conclusion that there is a widespread epidemic of voter fraud in the country based on no actual evidence. They'll just come to this conclusion. And if they decide that that's too bold, they will come to the conclusion that there is the potential for a widespread epidemic of voter fraud in the country. Either way, the purpose is to get to step 2, which is to erect obstacles to voting.
So this week, let's talk just generally about broader Democratic politics. This week, we saw the Senate Democratic leader Chuck Schumer, Nancy Pelosi, the House leader, the Democratic House leader, the Democratic Party chair, Tom Perez, unveil a campaign that's called A Better Deal for American Workers. Do you think that's a good slogan?
Well, look, I just think it's a fact. I mean, what our party is offering is a better deal, particularly if you compare it to what President Trump is offering the American people right now, which is, you know, the deal that he's offering is for himself. I mean, he sort of ran as this guy who was going to put the American people first. And what he was offering people was, he was saying, look, you know, yeah, I'm not very nice to people and you don't like me very much, but all this stuff I've done for myself, now I'm going to do it for you. It turns out he's still just doing it for himself. He's never transitioned from being the leader of the Trump organization to becoming the president of the United States. And so when you talk about a plan that offers more jobs, that offers higher wages, and that brings costs down, that is just factually a better deal. And it's focused on Americans instead of, you know, just one American, which is, I think, where President Trump's focus is on himself.
You know, we posted on social media and asked our listeners for their response or their reaction to that slogan. I got to say, we got some skepticism. Let me just read a couple of the tweets that we got. Chuck Matthews said, marketing BS to help keep their own jobs. Work on substance instead. Take a deep breath, reset, and focus on what's good for all Americans. And we heard from someone who identifies himself on Twitter as ex-GOPer, said, seems like a weak response to this administration. If we learned anything from 2016, it's go bold or go home. A better deal won't cut it. And finally, Dara Menth tweeted, my suggestion for a slogan, make America good again. Are slogans powerful things? Is it important for Democrats to think about what their slogan is?
Well, again, I don't really think of this as a slogan. I think of it as factually what they're offering. I mean, if you look at the substance of this is a label for what's being offered, right? And over the next, you know, obviously between now and November of 18, you're going to hear a lot more about the substance of this. And actually, you know, they laid out quite a bit of it the other day. So walk through some of what it is here, right? Like what our party's talking about is it's talking about, you know, a plan that would create 10 million jobs. It's talking about, you know, making sure that wages are higher and starting with raising the minimum wage, which will help all wages go up. It's talking about the fact that when you have huge monopolies that are being formed that President Trump is clearly going to do nothing about, a guy who's made his money in part by buying other companies, doesn't see anything wrong with that. Well, that drives costs up because, you know, when there's less competition, costs are a lot higher. And what's going on in the life of the average American right now is, and this is important, right? Because people don't experience issues one at a time. So we should talk about the way issues affect people in their lives. So, for instance, when we talk about raising the minimum wage, we should talk about raising wages for all people, including those in the minimum wage. And so what this is doing is it's saying, here's what we want to do. Here's the substance. But our party is saying, and here's what it'll mean in your life. And I think that's really important.
So here's the reason, or one reason, I think that some people nationally in the Democratic Party have taken some real interest in you and your future is the fact that in the Senate race that you had in Missouri last year, you ran 16 percentage points ahead of Hillary Clinton in Missouri. You picked up 220,000 crossover Trump voters. Is there, when you think about the Democratic Party generally, is there a lesson from your campaign and your ability to appeal to more than 200,000 folks who were also voting for President Trump? Is there a key to that? Is there a lesson from your experience?
Yes, and it's actually a really simple one. And the lesson is that, like, being successful in politics usually comes down to just being the same rule as being a good person, which is be who you are, tell people what you think. And look, we, as you said, substantially overperformed the presidential ticket last year. But, you know, in 2012, I actually won in Missouri on the same day that President Obama lost the state by almost 10 points. So this is something that's not just one election. We've done this before. And what it comes down to is my basic belief. And the other thing is, I like to point out to people that I didn't do that by pretending to be a conservative Democrat, right? I went out and told people what I believed. And in a state that President Trump won by 19 points, a whole lot of people voted for him and voted for me because they looked at it and said, thinking about me, saying, you know, I don't know that I agree with everything that this guy says, but I know that he's telling me the truth.
And I know that he really believes what he's saying, and I know that he believes it because he thinks it'll help me, right? Like, you have to tell people what you truly believe, and you have to make sure that they understand that you believe it because they're part of your plans too. And if you do that, that's just making an argument. And look, you don't win arguments you don't make, so you got to go out and make them.
So, you know, there's another reason people think you did so well, and that was this remarkable TV ad that you aired in which you were blindfolded. Tell our listeners what you then did.
So let me give you a little bit of the backstory. So I obviously come from a very pro-gun state, and I had the NRA had given me an F rating, but they hadn't just given me an F rating. The president of the NRA, Wayne LaPierre, had come to Missouri to personally campaign against me while the NRA was running millions of dollars in TV ads saying that I was the enemy. And so when that happened, this sort of gets to your last question, too. A lot of folks reached out to the campaign, and their suggestion was that I should make one of those ads where, you know, I shoot a really big gun and talk about how much I love hunting and basically pretend to be a Republican. But I haven't been hunting since I was a kid. And, you know, I didn't get into politics to play a character on TV.
So. I'm Jason Kander, and Senator Blunt has been attacking me on guns.
So that ad, in that ad, it's me talking about how in the Army I learned to use and protect my rifle.
In Afghanistan, I'd volunteer to be an extra gun in a convoy of unarmored SUVs. And in the state legislature, I supported Second Amendment rights. I also believe in background checks. So that
And it's me making an argument for background checks.
I approve this message. Because I'd like to see Senator Blunt do this.
And, you know, standing up to the NRA, making an argument for background checks, while simultaneously blindfolded assembling a rifle. And what that ad to me was, is me saying, look, I'm right about this, and the NRA is wrong, and by the way, I know what the heck I'm talking about, which is a perfect example of what we were talking about just a moment ago, right? So instead of going with a strategy that maybe a lot of people would have, which is trying to make voters believe that you really don't believe what people are saying you believe, well, instead of that, it's me saying, no, I do believe this, and I think I'm right, and I think you should agree with me. Well, even if people didn't ultimately agree with my argument, they looked at it and said, that guy's telling me the truth, and I see why he believes that, and he seems to believe it because he thinks it'll make a difference for me, and it'll keep me and my family safe.
I'll tell you, when I saw that ad, I thought, there's a guy who can assemble a rifle while he's blindfolded.
Yeah, well, you know, look, you got to give the United States Army credit for that.
I have another question on that. How many takes for that ad?
I got it on the first take. I don't, we did several because, you know, they always want to do stuff with lighting and stuff like that. But really the stuff I did with my hands was not the hard part because, you know, that's muscle memory. There have been plenty of times in the Army where I was in the woods and needed to clean my rifle at night, right? So that's kind of muscle memory. If there was a hard, quote unquote, hard part to it, it was that there's obviously no teleprompter under the blindfold. So I had to memorize that part.
So here's another issue like gun control that's been tough for Democrats with some voters, and that is transgender rights. And we've just had this week an announcement by the president that he is reversing, by President Trump, that he's reversing President Obama's policy that opens the military so people who are transgender can serve openly. And some political aides to the president are suggesting this is really going to put Democratic candidates in a hard place in states like Missouri or even states like Michigan and Wisconsin, where there'll be conservative voters who will not like the fact that if Democratic candidates are defending transgender rights. What's your thought on this? Do you think this is an issue that could hurt Democrats?
Look, my thought on this is that that's exactly what's wrong with the Trump administration right now, is that they are making a decision about national security based on how it will help or hurt them in an election. And I find that offensive as an American. I find it offensive as a veteran. I mean, we're talking about, first of all, what we also know is that the Pentagon is in the middle of studying this. The Pentagon hasn't made a decision. And President Trump is pretending that this was a Pentagon decision because he doesn't want to own it. It's a political decision that's going to result in disruption to our military, which weakens us as a country, makes us less safe. And by the way, even just on a human level, there's about 4,000 people who are going to be out of work because the president would like the political advantage. Honestly, that's just gross. I mean, he's the president of the United States. That is not a way to make a decision. And it bothers me because what bothers me as an American, but like I said, when I was in the military, we were just trying to do our job. This is not the kind of thing that we were worried about. You know, if somebody had the courage to join up and serve, Well, then that meant that they had a lot more courage than, frankly, this president has ever had in his entire life. And I think he ought to show some respect for that.
So from your perspective as a military veteran, it didn't make a difference to you if you had people who were openly gay or openly transgender in the ranks with you?
No. What we care about in the military is whether you're going to do your job. You know, that's what we care about, because the job is really important. Period. End of story.
We talked a little about the Democratic leaders who unveiled this new slogan early this week. And you look at them, Nancy Pelosi, she's 77 years old. Chuck Schumer is 66. Joe Biden, 74. Bernie Sanders, 75. Elizabeth Warren is 68. So these are all the big names in the Democratic Party. They're all eligible for Social Security. And I wonder if you think is that a problem for the party? Is it important that there'll be younger voices like yourself, you're 36, taking more of a role?
Well, look, I think that's something that's clearly happening. There clearly are a lot of folks across the generations who are standing up right now. But this question comes up a lot when I do interviews like this. People will ask sort of who are the leaders of the party, that kind of thing. And the truth is, you know, I've been traveling all over the country for the past 6 months, and people aren't really pointing to a single figure in Washington as the source of all this energy. I mean, it really is coming from the grassroots. And I constantly meet people who got involved after January 20th, and they've done something to fight back against this president every single day since then. And I've never seen this kind of energy in politics in my entire lifetime. And what I think, when you talk about individuals that motivate people or bring people into the process, what I see more often than anything, rather than people looking toward a politician that they see on TV as sort of the person going to take them to the promised land, if there's an individual, it's usually their neighbor who, you know, invited them to a little house party where they were all going to make phone calls to senators about the health care bill or write letters to the editor. That's the person who's brought them in. And that's why I'm so optimistic about what's going on politically in the country right now in terms of the momentum. I think the momentum is clearly with us because, you know, people, 54% of the folks who voted for somebody not named Donald Trump, and folks aren't waiting to stand up and fight back.
So let me ask you one last question. You mentioned you've been traveling all over the country. That includes places like Iowa and New Hampshire and the places that presidential hopefuls tend to go hang out when they're thinking about having a presidential, making a presidential bid. And I wonder if you think it is feasible for someone to run for president if they've only been elected to a state legislature and as a statewide official, to be sure, but as Secretary of State, not as governor. Or is it necessary when people, especially in a post-Trump era, where we've had this president who had lacked governmental experience before, is it necessary, if you wanted to be president, for you to get elected to some other job first?
Well, look, first of all, I'm flattered by the question. It's a flattering question. But, you know, second, as for what I'm thinking about right now, genuinely, as we talked about a few minutes ago, I'm focused on making sure that we're still holding elections in this country. And as for me, if I'm successful in that, then maybe one day I'll be in one. And as for all that other stuff, I mean, that's more of a political pundit question. I'm just a guy out there trying to make sure that we still let Americans vote.
Jason Kander, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And finally, from the archives, earlier this week, we learned more about the link between repeated head trauma and the risk of neurodegenerative brain disease. Researchers studying the brains of former NFL football players found that 99% of those they examined suffered from the disease. In 2012, Diane discussed this issue and whether it was safe for kids to play the game. Here's author and sports writer Stefan Fatsis.
Stefan Fatsis, is it possible to make football safer for kids?
I don't think so, given its current configuration. And I think part of the problem is simply who children are. You can teach all the technique you want, but children don't have the cognitive or physical ability very often, as 5 minutes on the sideline of any sports game, youth sports event will show you, to implement and control their bodies when they want to or when they should. So I'm very skeptical that it can change. And I think coaches, for all their well-meaningness, youth coaches are mostly parents. They are not particularly well-educated. With all due respect to Mark, there is a lack of sophistication, and there are sort of conflicting motives when parents are coaching. They don't understand children very often, and they don't understand the sport at a very nuanced level. I think there are ways to ease children into tackle football when they go through puberty, as Dr. Cantu has indicated, without sapping their love or their interest in this sport. Playing flag football would be one way. Gradually padding them up and playing flag football while teaching different techniques would be another way. But I think to subject children to repeated subconcussive blows from the ages of five, which is where Pop Warner football can begin, 5 years old and 35 pounds, I think is just the common sense is telling us that this is no longer smart.
You can listen to that entire segment on dianereem.org. That's our show for this week. Diane's podcast, On My Mind, is taking a summer break. We'll be back after Labor Day. Please stay in touch with us on Facebook, Twitter, and email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Or leave us a voicemail. The number is 202-854-8851. And go to our website, dianereem.org, for Diane's latest blog post. Our theme music is composed by Cliff Harden and comes to us courtesy of the Capitol Soundtrack Project here at WAMU. The show is produced by Sandra Baker and Rebecca Kaufman. Thanks for listening. This is Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm.